I'm next, so I think it's really important that Iraq be a topic at this conference, anti-war conference, not only because there are very serious threats of massively bombing Iraq once again, but because there is an ongoing war against Iraq since basically 1990. I mean, the preparation started in 1990, and there was the Gulf War. And after that, war against Iraq continued through the implementation and the maintaining of the sanctions. Very often people mobilize when there's like threats of bombing, and after that the mobilization just fizzles. And what happened with Iraq is that because of the sanctions over that period of 11 years, it's estimated about 1.5 million people died. So many, many more people died as a result of the cumulative effect of both the bombing and the sanctions. It's one of the most important humanitarian crises in the last many decades, actually. 1.5 million people don't die in every country very frequently. It's mostly children that are affected. If you only consider children under 5 years of age, and only the 8-year period between 1991 and 1998, UNICEF has established in a very, very sophisticated survey carried out all over Iraq in cities and villages in a very scientific way. UNICEF has established that 500,000 children under 5 years old have died, which would not have died without the sanctions between 91 and 98. And kids keep on dying at the rate of 150 to 200 every day. Why is this happening? I'm not talking about the deep causes, but how mostly it's happening right now. First of all, the Gulf War was not what was seen on TV. The Gulf War did target the infrastructure of the country, did target civilian targets, water supply, food warehouses, some schools, most of the electricity installations and transmission systems. It was proven, actually, that the Pentagon had circulated a document at the very beginning of the preparations called the Iraq Water Treatment Vulnerabilities. This document has been made public by a professor in the United States, and this document explains what would happen if the water system was targeted, and it was targeted, and what was planned did actually happen in terms of massive epidemics at first, and in terms of all kinds of minor diseases which are easily curable, but when you don't have the medical infrastructure, when you don't have some basic medication, you can't cure them. So most kids in Iraq die of things like pneumonia, die of diarrhea, die of things that are caused by parasites in water, and their immune system being weakened. They're easy targets for a lot of illnesses. We've put genocide as a keyword in our title for the workshop, just to indicate that this is not an exaggeration. We're not using this to have an effect, or 1.5 million people is already a lot of people, and people are still dying. And this humanitarian crisis is one of the most well-documented in history, I would say. Every major humanitarian agency has written lengthy reports about it, and many agencies repeated reports. And the policy is still kept, still maintained. Initially, George Bush Sr. made some statements before the war that they would bring Iraq back to the Middle Ages. Now, when you make a statement like that, it implies you're not going only to target the military. It implies you're going to target whatever makes life, modern life, possible in the country. And that was done. When Madeleine Albright was asked a couple of years ago whether 500,000 kids was a price worth paying, she said, yes, it's a price worth paying. So it's not denying that this is happening. It's, you know, maybe you can look at it as a side effect on their part, but it's happening and they maintain the policy. If you look at the Convention on Genocide that was adopted by the United Nations in 1948, it does not require that there is an intent to destroy the whole population. It says a population in whole or in part. And creating the conditions that will have as a consequence the dying of the whole population or a part of the population is considered a crime of genocide. The idea of this convention is to try also and prevent genocide. So basically, you don't declare a genocide only after everybody's dead. You try to identify the crime and you try to stop it while it is being committed. This was the basic reason for the resignation of two assistant secretary generals of the United Nations. And one repeatedly calls this a genocide. The other one doesn't quite use that wording, but was certainly clear that this is a totally illegal policy that goes against the United Nations Charter, against the Declaration of Human Rights. Recently on TV and in newspapers, we've been reading that sanctions are not killing people in Iraq. Not really. It's not really sanctioned. We've had someone, I think McDonald, a journalist on CBC, walk in the street telling us, oh, there's brand new cars around, things seem to be much improved, etc. Basically, people who don't know what they're talking about, a little bit like Chrétien, who doesn't know if he's in East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem when he goes to Palestine. I think, you know, if you're in the right neighborhood, you'll see a lot of brand new cars. In 2000, we saw a lot of brand new cars in a particular neighborhood. And it's obvious that the top strata of the Iraqi society is still very well off and benefits from the embargo. There's a booming black market and they control it, and they have access to wealth and they have access to just about anything. As usual, it's the people who pay for a crisis. It's not the rich people in a society. Because we don't have much time, I'm not going to go into the detailed aspects of the impact of sanctions, but it affects everything: education, women and their health, babies at their birth, the death rate, etc. We could go on and on about this. Just in terms of the economy, the largest bill in Iraq when we were there in 2000 was a 250 dinars. This was worth, before the Gulf War, $800 American. And when we were there, it was worth about 12 cents. So the same bill from $800 American to 12 Canadian cents, or US cents, sorry. This is a massive, massive economic collapse. I'd like to end with Canada in all this. Canada is not a minor player. It is a small player, but it is a very important player in this. Reading back about Resolution 678, this is a Security Council resolution adopted in November 1990. This resolution authorized member states to use all means necessary. And this is what basically authorized the Gulf War in the eyes of the coalition. Four countries were basically movers of that resolution: the United States, Great Britain, Soviet Union, still sort of existed at the time, and the fourth is Canada. Canada was already in the planning stages knowing what was coming up. Canada had the fourth largest contingent in the war. It's been presented, and it was the case for several weeks, that they were mostly, if not exclusively, in support tasks. But it's also been established more recently that in the last couple of weeks, Canada did participate in bombing raids. Certainly did in Kosovo. Canada spent over $1 billion since 1990 to participate in the Gulf War and to participate in sanctions. We're still sending frigates. It's costing Canadian taxpayers roughly $36 million a year to send those frigates to participate in the implementation of the embargo. And Canada participates in the disinformation full scale. When the United States or Great Britain starts saying that Iraq is a threat to the region or Iraq is a threat to the world, you hear Etienne or back then Mulroney echoing the same thing. Our external affairs representative has basically the same discourse as the United States. There's no talk about the impact on the population. If there is, it's to blame it on Saddam. I didn't expand on this. I mean, our group clearly considers that Saddam Hussein is a dictator, but we also are convinced that if Iraq had no oil, there would not have been all this tremendous carnage and destruction of the country and suffocating of its people. So dictatorships, we don't think, are a big concern for our own government or the American government, but having access to some of the most important resources in the world is what it's all about. So as Canadians, we have a responsibility towards the people of Iraq to stop our government from implementing these policies on our behalf. And we can't always say Canada can't do anything, Canada can't do anything. Small countries do something. Like Cuba, which is a tiny country, which doesn't have the wealth and resources of Canada, stood up to all this throughout. Every single resolution they voted against consistently because they happened to be at the Security Council in 1990-1991. They're the only country that did this. Of course, there's a price, but if we mean we can't do a thing and keep all of our wealth and all of our lifestyle and all of our living standards, then maybe it's true. Because the great big bully of the world is going to make anybody who stands in their way pay. But the question is, you know, how important are our principles? Do we have any? Or is our chief principle our standard of living? And so that's one important issue that we have to resolve for ourselves and for, you know, the population in general in Canada to stand up against such devastating policies.
Thank you very much, Raymond.